remember. Reserve Bank Governor, Jill Marcus, Acting DG, Momo. first, let me start by indicating that the chair had some challenges on his way here this morning, and hence a little bit of a delay in the meeting. But nonetheless, I think what we should be focusing on is for the business of the day. The DG, National Treasury, is overseas, and the minister is also tied up, including the deputy minister. But the team from National Treasury and the South African Reserve Bank present here is capable enough to give us the responses insofar as the amendment as tabled before this committee is concerned. One of the things that we should be mindful of is that this process has attracted a lot of interest. We have almost permanently so had the media presence in all our public hearings. I would want to appeal that whatever documentation is distributed amongst committee members, it's a public document, but should be handled responsibly so, particularly insofar as the reporting out there in terms of the media. There's nothing untoward. It's a process that all of us knew from the beginning, that it's a very exciting process, robust debate, Governor, I must just say to you, we've had very interesting presentations, and I'm sure you have also seen through written submissions, and your team might also have reported to you together with Momo that it is a piece of legislation or amendment that has indeed kept the committee busy. Having said so, I think I should then allow National Treasury to respond to the issues that have been raised, both in written and verbal submissions to the committee, and we'll take it from there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chair, I should say that just in opening up, we have obviously spent a lot of time going through all the presentations or reports submitted to Parliament on the bill, and as with every bill, gone through them. And what we have here is just, we thought with the SARP, because this is one presentation, that we just wanted to outline a broad response, which will indicate to what extent we've taken quite seriously all the inputs made to Parliament, and determine and bring forward to you just our response to many of the issues raised. So just to start off, I think, you know, we thought it's quite important to clarify the role of government, because I think much has been said in some of the submissions which in some instances tends to confuse. I think just to make some obvious points, the government established the central bank. In our case, of course, we call it the South African Reserve Bank. This was done in 1921, if I remember my history. So it's older than all of us in this room. secondly, I think, just to make the point that in establishing the central bank, government still sets the policy goal in most instances, and the bank has the operational independence with regard to implementation. Government, and we'll come back to those points, because I think clearly it impacts on monetary policy, for example, on banking regulation, on a few areas that critical functions that no doubt the bank plays. I think just to make a point that government receives 90% of the bank's profits, but I should add that government then bears most of the losses. And if you look at the last point, I mean, government is the ultimate guarantor to the central bank, certainly not the shareholders. For that reason, the president appoints the governor and the three deputy governors. Let me jump. Go back. Yeah. And three independent directors. That's currently. And again, just to make the point that in exercising its responsibility, the bank does so in the broader public interest. And for example, in managing the reserves, they are held in trust by the government. By the bank. They're not owned by the bank. Move on. I think just to remind ourselves, Chair and members, that though it was established in 1921, the Constitution clearly establishes the SAB in terms of Section 223 of the Constitution. And in this sense, it's a constitutional institution. The Constitution also provides that an act deals with any other functions and its operations, and therefore you've got to read Section 223 with the South African Reserve Bank Act. To make the important point, it does have independence within government in the way it operates. The Constitution requires it to act without fear, favor, or interference. If you look at Section 224, the Constitution also, I mean, though there's independence, there must be regular consultation with the Minister of Finance. I think to also just make the point, since it has come up in some of the hearings, that the SARB is not a private company. And for that reason, it's not governed by the Companies Act. And neither is it governed by the PFMA. In fact, specifically exempted from the PFMA, just given the nature of the SAR. As I've said, it's a creature of the statute in terms of the Constitution, the SAB Act, which is in terms of Section 225 of the Constitution. So I think, Chair, this is just to outline broadly what the Constitution says, what the legislation says. I think just to, by way of an example, if you look at the area of monetary policy and the role of the SAB, I mean, and some of the recent initiatives since 1994, historically monetary policy, not just in South Africa, all over the world, was very opaque, and it's only in the 80s and 90s that you began to get more transparency in the way central banks operate. Before, like in other countries, decisions were not announced, but left to the markets to interpret what the decision was. There was, but in some of the reforms that we've undertaken, they've included, for example, that the decisions are taken by the governor and the two deputy governors, the three deputy governors in this instance, and to point out that the governors who make those decisions on monetary policy are appointed by the president to carry out monetary policy. They're not told what monetary policy should be. Yes, targets are set, but the governors have the operational independence then to operate when they implement monetary policy. And the current system that we have is much more transparent than what was the case before, both because of international developments and the reforms that we undertook as a country. As you know, every time the Monetary Policy Committee sits, the governors therefore act through that committee. They appoint one or two other people who advise them, and after every meeting they issue a statement and they explain their thinking, so that the markets kind of understand how they're acting. But perhaps the governor could come in. I don't know if she wants to come in now or at some point to explain that. Just then to remind ourselves, I mean, the bank also performs a range of other functions aside from the monetary policy function, which everybody knows about, the setting of interest of the repo rate. I mean, the bank's constitutional responsibility is to maintain the value of the currency in the interest of sustainable growth and development. As I've said, the bank is there to serve the public interest, not any specific private interest, but the broad public interest. It's co-responsible with the Treasury, with government, to ensure that there's a stable macroeconomic environment. It has a whole range of international and national obligations which the governor can expand on. Its responsibilities include not just around the currency, but the payment system, things that you don't see, things that, in fact, when there's a problem, you'll see just what the SARP actually has to do quietly behind the scenes. Run the payment systems, regulate the banking sector, is an active player in financial markets. It's a banker to government. It manages the country's reserves. It has played the role of administering exchange controls, and of course, it's responsible for implementing monetary policy. None of these functions, I should add, could really be efficiently done by private companies. So I don't think there's any doubt that the bank is there to serve the public interest. And clearly, even though it may make a profit now and then and not always, its purpose is not to to maximize profit for shareholders, but to act in this broader public interest. So, Chair, I thought I should just give that broad overview. Perhaps the governor may want to add. I think that there's a whole range of very specific issues that were raised, and I thought we certainly thought the governor is probably best placed to just deal with those specific issues that come up in the bill. Governor?
Thanks very much, and thank you, Chair. Perhaps just to introduce the team from the Reserve Bank, on my left is Legal Counsel Johan de Jager. Sitting behind me will be Tlengani Matebula, and who's responsible for strategy and communication, and Brian Hoger, who's parliamentary liaison. And then we have from our external legal team, Chris Moraitis, further to my left, and Toka Zambani, who is operating the computer here. And thank you for enabling us to participate today, Chair.
Can I just make up for my rudeness in not introducing our team from the Treasury? We have Rebecca T., who heads our legal services, and Olano Makubela, who's in the financial sector policy unit. I know they've been with you, but I want to just acknowledge, and of course, all our parliamentary staff like Cindy and company are present.
We've tried in this response between the Treasury and ourselves is to look at the broad overview in terms of the detail. I mean, line by line, we will certainly also provide that to you. But perhaps just to start with the nature of the board. This is extremely important because there is a distinction. It is a governance board, not a policy board. As was set out in the earlier slides, the things that we are responsible for, the amendment makes it explicit that this is a direct responsibility, not a delegated function. The question around a delegated function is that it can be delegated today and not delegated or withdrawn on a different occasion, and you need to have original power for the implementation because this is a governance board and that is its purpose, that has been its practice, and the amendment just emphasizes the distinction. And that draws the distinction between the governance and the day-to-day running of the bank as well as the policy implementation. The bill entrenches the prevailing practice, but does not rely on that delegation. It creates the original powers of the executive of the SARB. And that's extremely important to have that because these are decisions that are required all the time and where you are totally accountable for. And you have no other conflict. That is your job. There's nothing else that you come along and from a board where you may have other interests have different views. So the actual implementation of your task is the responsibility in terms of what is envisaged for the executives of the bank. What does the board require? In our view, a board requires to be able for people to have people who are certainly attend for their in a responsible manner not just board, but also committees. They need the requisite knowledge. They need to be accountable in relation to that knowledge. And there is a process of evaluation, both for individual members, that is executive and non-executive, individual evaluation for members of the board, as well as evaluation of the committee and the board as a whole. The committees that the board is involved in are really the core ones are audit, risk, the non-executive directors committee, and the remuneration committee. They meet on a frequent basis. That is part of our annual report as to what they meet on, what their findings are, what their responsibilities are. The risk committee of the board is a new committee that was established this year. And there's an annual review in terms of governance around the board's terms of reference of all committees, attendance, participation, skill and knowledge, is it achieving? And what it does is from the board obviously act in terms of the implementation side from the bank. Is the bank's operational approach and to controls and risks appropriate? To bear in mind that, for example, with REMCO, one of the comments made in the submissions is the governor should not sit on the remuneration committee. Personally, I would not agree with that. A remuneration committee with the human resource department of the bank develops the whole HR strategy. It looks at the remuneration policy. It looks at leave and sick policy. All of these matters are dealt with through your remuneration committee and the department in the bank. If the governor is not part of that, how do you deal with those issues? The point that must be made, and that would be in the terms of reference, is that, or should be in the terms of reference, is that any discussion on the remuneration of a governor should make sure that the governor is not present and has no influence over that. But for other parts, for participation in the REMCO, certainly, if one took the audit committee and the relationship between the two, it's a very clearly established policy that your audit committee, the internal auditor, must have a direct line to the chair of your audit committee. Your audit committee must be chaired by a non-exec director. The governor is an invitee. You can sit in and answer questions. You are accountable, but you are not a member of that committee. So those are the kind of practices that we do follow in the bank. But it is very important, and obviously the internal auditor also has a direct line of interaction to the governor as, in essence, the CEO, to ensure that the issues that are being found in the organization are brought to attention of the executive and they are dealt with, so that there's the full functioning of the board in that regard and the requisite skills that are required in that sense. If we looked at the question of what we think in the amendment also addresses, is how do you elect these non-executive directors? Now, the process that we're following here is, first of all, to look at fit and proper. And the amendment spells out fit and proper in keeping with what is there in other legislation and specifically states that your fiduciary duty of a non-executive director and your duty of care and skill is owed to the South African Reserve Bank. It is not. And this is an important question because I know that some of the comments made were around shareholder representative or government representative. You have a unitary board, and whoever elects you or what route you come onto that board, that should not be the case of what determines your actions, including where, as it is in the Act, come from finance or from agriculture. You're not there with a mandate to look at agriculture-specific issues. You're there to look at what is the functioning of the institution. And is it fulfilling its responsibilities? Otherwise, you don't have a board that functions in a unitary manner or with the appropriate duties of care and skill and their fiduciary duties to the institution. Why you stipulate some of the resources, and they're not limited to that, is that it's because it's not representation from them. It's not a mandated position. It is about knowledge of those areas. So that you act, because the board in many ways should act as a resource, as a support, as an information, as a check, as a control, in terms of your understanding of what is happening. And why it's drawn from those areas is because the input and knowledge of people with that expertise adds value to the discussions that take place about what is happening in the real economy and makes the board a meaningful board. If you look at it as representation, if you come from agriculture and you see yourself as a shareholder representative, then your issue is focused, am I dealing with agriculture only? Does it feature? How does it play? And you do not look at your role for the board as a whole. So our view is it changes this to the knowledge of those areas, because that is very helpful to the discussions on the board. But it is not, and it, the crucial question is that you are a unitary board. And there cannot be a different expectation or a different demand on you depending on who has, whether you're a shareholder representative or an appointment made by government. You have the same responsibility. So in that sense, that's quite an important change in our view to create a better coherence and purposefulness and accountability in the board. The process of nomination and why you've set it up in this way is that if you have a situation of simply the shareholders nominating as it is, a very small body of shareholders. We have 630-odd shareholders in total. And one of the allegations or comments made was that the shareholder register is inaccurate. We have audited internally and externally. There's no discrepancy in the shareholder register that we're aware of. So the process of nomination is to enable the wider public of South Africa. As you've indicated yourself, Chair, this amendment has attracted a lot of interest. The role of the Reserve Bank in society is an extremely important one. Our approach is we want to enhance the role of shareholders. We would like a broader representation of shareholder interests, and certainly shareholders of the bank, where price matters in that regard as well. So for us, the nomination is about broadening the base, enabling a wider society to have a say in who are the potential board members, and then having a process by which you are set up how you actually look at those board members in relation to the kind of knowledge, fit and proper, etc. And I'll come back to that just now. This process, in our view, entrenches the bank's independence, because there is not a body holding a block of shares. If you have a situation, or the argument has been put forward, well, government could own, well, then you do actually have a situation where you have an ownership that is particularly strong. This allows a situation of independence and accountability. You're accountable because you have a wide range of shareholders of nomination, you have a wider participation, and the additional board member, as one of the comments we made was, why move to 15, why not go down to 13? Well, the number 13 or 15 is a reasonable size of the board. You know, you're not looking at a very big board here to look at numbers, so one additional person, in our view, is useful from this point of view. Why would you not go down to 13? But you've got current incumbents, and then it becomes something else. You could do it, but it's to me, it's neither here nor there of 13 or 15. It's just adding an additional place. But what it does do, and this is the thinking behind it, is that enhances the cohesion vis-a-vis the governor. At the moment, you have 7-7 with a governor with a casting vote. So in essence, you put the governor as an arbiter all the time. The governor, as chair, is also responsible for the cohesion of the board, the engagement of the board, and if you're in a situation where the governor, if there was to be a split decision 7-7, I'm not aware of it ever occurring, but you're putting the situation where the deciding factor is the governor's casting vote, and therefore you're changing the relationship of the governor in relation to the board, whereas this would be a clear question that you can have a majority vote. The assumption that government appointees will automatically vote with the executive is not necessarily correct. I think that if you're having the duties of care and skill, the expectation is that should there be a vote, you must vote on the issue, and it may well be different in that regard. And if there was to be a situation of that nature where you had a question where you were unable to function, then my view is you've actually created a board that is dysfunctional, and part of this change is to ensure that we do not get a board where you have members of the board whose purpose is not the same as the interests and obligations and the work of the South African Reserve Bank. So perhaps that is just some explanation of that. If we look at the shareholding, the Saab, as has been said, is not a private company, and the shareholders set out in the Saab Act have limited rights. I think this is important because anybody who is a shareholder today, this Act came into place in 1989, anybody who is a shareholder today knows the limits of the Act because they were there. These are not new limits. This is nothing that has been introduced now or is being introduced in the amendment that was not there. So if you looked at it, the approach here is the widest possible representation which creates a limitation on shareholding, whether individual or corporate. The intention is not to have a block of opinion that can influence in a particular direction. So that as an individual, you have a limit on the number of shares and a limit of the number of votes. And if you're a corporate or an institution, you have the same limit. So you do not have the ability to have, if you looked at it, there may be particular interest from the financial sector or the mining sector or whatever to say we're going to have shares and we're going to put our members on the board. The purpose of that is to prevent that. So when we're looking at this, this isn't about the current holding simply. It is about a mechanism to ensure that you do not have interested parties acting together to be able to get people on the board with a particular purpose that is not necessarily the purpose of the South African Reserve Bank. The ownership of shares is limited precisely to prevent acting in concert with the intent of undue influence. And therefore, the amendment around associates is to ensure that this is spelled out very clearly, because it has obviously been circumvented at this point in time. The second element around that is the fixed return. This confirms that this is not for profit, and it reasserts the public interest role. The question that you do have a fixed dividend that is paid does mean that people have not entered or become shareholders of this institution for profit. And let me just stay with that a second. You know, how if you looked at a mining company or a manufacturing company or a retail house, they conduct business in which they may not make a profit. It depends on what they do, what they sell, what they produce, what they dig out of the ground, and how they run their costs and expenses and make their investments. That will determine whether they make a profit or a loss. The South African Reserve Bank can make a profit simply because the circumstances are such that other things happen that have resulted in being a providing currency. You get seen rich on currency. It is something that you make a profit on. It is a public good. You can't look at it and say, well, that profit should be shared to shareholders. It's not something that you have created or done outside of what your purpose for it is as a public duty. And therefore, the profits that you make are not something that is an earning because of activity that is profit-motivated or the conduct of business is to make a profit. Similarly, with losses, if the shareholders want to share in the profits, they must equally be able to share in the losses. And the losses will bankrupt those shareholders. So that if you're in a situation of being available for profiting, you've also got to be. And part of the question is you would make a loss, or you can make a loss, if one takes the current circumstance, because of prevailing market conditions. You're not making a loss because you're making a bad investment. You're making a loss because you're carrying out your public duty. And in that public duty, one of the consequences is that you as an entity are serving the interests of the country, but as an entity, you're making a loss by doing that. It's a bit of an anomaly if you took a situation, say, with some of the central banks around the world, where their banking sector and some of the corporates got into huge trouble. And when a bank gets into trouble, one of the best practice, if you're dealing with a bank in difficulty, is that you do lend them money, but you do it at very penal rates. So the outcome of it is that in fixing the bank, you actually may become very profitable. So if you looked at some of the central banks at this moment where the country is in the hugest amount of difficulty and they've got a failing banking system, the central banks have made a lot of money because the lending at that point in time is penal because that's what you're making sure that they cannot become reliant on you. You want them to fix their situation. You want them out of the system as quickly as possible. It would be totally absurd that because of that, shareholders must benefit to the tune of that because that's not what you're doing. You're acting in the public good. You're acting to achieve a particular goal, which may have profits or otherwise. So this argument about that you should have 10% of the profits may apply in a normal company, but it is wholly inappropriate in a central bank. And the question then becomes, shareholding in a central bank does not equate to ownership. It is an interest in, but the ownership, it is a legal entity. And the other point about the question of some of the comments, and I'm trying to address some of the comments that have been made, as we're going through this, is that the actions in this amendment violate the bilateral treaty. Well, that's, I'm quite sure that those who are proposing that will take their legal advice, and with all due respect to legal advice, you often get the legal advice you're looking for. The question is, it is stipulated in the 1989 Act, and there's no amendment to that in this Act. is that you need to be ordinarily resident in South Africa. This has got nothing to do with nationality. If a South African who is a shareholder lives abroad and does not ordinarily reside in South Africa, they are not entitled to vote. Equally, if a foreign national lives in South Africa and is a shareholder, there's no restriction on a foreign national being a shareholder, and if they live in South Africa, they're entitled to vote. However, if that same person goes abroad, just as a South African might, and does not ordinarily reside here, the Act stipulates that you do not vote. Why? Because the central bank is about being engaged, responsible, to, in terms, as again coming back to the question of public interest and public good. And you as a citizen or a person living in the country is affected by its decisions. And therefore, when you live in the country, you are affected by the decisions of the Reserve Bank. As a shareholder, you're entitled to vote. If you're living abroad, you are not affected by the decisions of the Reserve Bank. And the Act had that clause in precisely to say, if you're affected by the bank, irrespective of nationality, if you're a shareholder, you can vote. But if you're not affected by it, you play no role in it. And therefore, your vote is simply a vote for whatever reason, but it is not because you are acting as part of the accountability, part of the good governance of a central bank. And the bank, or the banks, the SARB Act also prohibits shareholding by nominees. If we then move to some of the abuse by shareholders, what we've seen is the acquiring of shares above the legal limit, which is 10,000 shares per individual or corporate or institution with 50 votes through associates with the purpose of exercising undue influence. And this isn't simply about, I have 10,000 shares and we believe in the bank and maybe my spouse also has 10,000 shares. This is about a way of accumulating a body of shares through a multiplicity of obtaining those shares with the purpose of undue influence. Offers of payment for votes in favor of the appointment as a director have taken place. I will read you a letter to shareholders by somebody who was standing for the board. And I'm not going to read the whole letter, but this is part of it. I have decided to honor the shareholders' wishes that should I be elected to the board, I will do so in the following manner. I will give all those shareholders who can prove that they voted for me an increase of 20% and do so for the next four dividend declarations. Right? Now, hang on a second. Is this fit and proper? Is this something that you want to have a process by which you can organize, you can be nominated by a family member, you can stand, that is what your commitment is, you're offering money to vote for me. Really, in a central bank with this kind of responsibility, I think is wholly inappropriate. And therefore, we come to some of the other abuse. Manipulation of beneficial ownership to exercise undue influence. Shareholders demanding a share in the profits of the bank, including adopting resolutions to try to give effect to this. This was done in 2003, and the question is, it was very clear by the board that this could not be done, it is not illegal, you have to have a legal amendment, took no notice of that and decided to make that resolution. But again, what does it indicate? It indicates that the presence of shareholders in that meeting was of sufficient number and influence to be able to pass a resolution against the wishes of the board and against the law with the objective of changing the profits. And that's why this amendment matters, because this has been going on since then. A demanding special extraordinary meeting. I mean, I'm sure many members are familiar with this because this was distributed to the press by themselves, in which they would come in to further the profit agenda, and in doing so, disregarding the provisions of the SARB Act in terms of holding such meetings. But if you looked at the what was tabled, they would come in. We were asked to hold the meeting, to convene the meeting, but they would come in and change the chair, appoint a new legal counsel, appoint a secretary, and run a meeting. Now, you can't have, is that a takeover of shareholders to make a change, to demand profit changes and dividend changes? Is this appropriate, and must this Reserve Bank and the country simply stand and let this happen? In our view, this is totally inappropriate, and hence the amendment. I've dealt with the question of stating that the shareholder register is inaccurate. We think this is unfounded. We've had external and internal auditors arising from the allegation, and it's found to be unsubstantiated. Also, regular unsubstantiated allegations of fraud, corruption, bank bailouts, and so on, and spurious. These spurious allegations t- take an extraordinary amount of time of the management, of the executives, and one is not in any way minimizing the importance of engaging with shareholders. My own approach is that I would like to regularly engage with shareholders, but over meaningful issues, and not constantly, year after year, dealing with this kind of approach. In terms of the panel, there's a lot being discussed around the panel and where this should reside. In terms of the panel, it broadens the pool. The approach and the purpose of the panel is to broaden the pool from which directors are nominated and elected. The requirement of the panel is to ensure fit and proper, knowledgeable directors are elected. The panel system is used in other sectors and in other central banks, some other central banks, and the panel enhances the independence. NEDLAC, why NEDLAC? NEDLAC is a statutory body representing organized business, labor, community, and development interests, as well as government. It is therefore unique in nature and best placed to represent all these interests. The essence of it is that your NEDLAC, which represents and has a community chamber, a government chamber, a business, and a labor, this is a question which meets regularly. It has a particular role in society, has been established in terms of law, and therefore for each of them to nominate a person to sit on the panel allows a representation and an inclusion about people who have this as what they do in terms of ensuring that you have a panel that is comprised of different members. The role of the governor in that regard, and I think in that, it's really simple, because the governor does not choose anybody out of that. The nominations come two from the minister, three from NEDLAC, and the governor simply gives effect to that. So who the people are, the governor has no say in who those people are. The governor simply administratively ensures that they are technically appointed. You are now a member of this panel, and we convene at this point in time. So it's not that the governor picks their own people for the panel. The governor has no say in who those people are. Those bodies are the ones who determine who the panel members are. The job of the governor is to ensure that it is convened and that it does its job. So, and that is extremely important in terms of that, because we've seen, and if you look at many areas, this is something the governor would be accountable to the board and accountable to shareholders on. If a panel was not convened timeously or appropriately, your whole question of what happens at an AGM or in terms of your AGM and you haven't got a nomination when there's a vacancy, there's something that you're going to obviously be asked, why did that happen? Because you're then responsible for ensuring that it does. So I think there is an accountability and a vehicle through which that is done, and in my view, it addresses the timeliness that is required, that enables the kind of consultation that is required to do that. But again, just to emphasize, the governor has no say over who the members of the panel are. That is the minister. And again, when you're looking at it, some of the points made is that, it would be useful to have a former governor on the panel. Yes, it would. But business, labor, community, or minister are entitled to appoint whoever they think is appropriate. And if you don't stipulate, in my view, the only thing about a retired judge, which is a stipulation, is because it creates a legal status to it and involvement. But from any other quarter, you're looking for an appropriate skill in that panel, and you should be able to draw on anybody within those members, so that while you're appointed from a particular origin, who you appoint is entirely up to what you've achieved as consensus, whether you're government, business, labor, or community. And you're looking at appointing a panel that has the requisite knowledge. So if there was a former governor, there's absolutely nothing stopping that. In relation to what the panel would consider, because you want a panel of knowledgeable people to evaluate. So the panel is as important as the people you're putting as non-execs. So in essence, I think that those cover a lot of the areas that I think were raised. In essence, we've also been, there was also a point about why the time frame for this. There have been, I think, a due process. It was a point we made in the presentation when we presented the amendments to the committee, is that we felt full process should be undertaken. 28 calendar days have been allowed for presentations. I think that you've had, in fact, a substantial body of comments and you know, I'm not sure what more would have been added if there had been more time, because I think these are very substantive in-depth comments made by Rating Africa about governance. We were a little surprised, because I would have thought this issue has been going on around shareholders for 7 years. If you're worried about governance, you've had plenty of time to look into the matter. And certainly there's been no engagement with us or an assessment of the governance of the bank. So, you know, I'm not sure how one could take that further. I would have thought if you wanted to comment on central bank governance, you need to actually talk to the bank, at least. The issue around shareholder matters affecting the SARVA said has been there for a number of years, and we're now dealing with it because it is important to deal with the risks arising from these activities. We welcome the substantive comments that have been received, the public hearings, the due process, and we want to thank you for the opportunity to be with you here today, and between us and the National Treasury, we're happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Governor. And acting DG, do you have anything to add for that moment? Okay.
He's asking you to add.
No.
Oh, okay. Honorable members, we now have a full response by the National Treasury together with the South African Reserve Bank Governor. And I think this presentation really and the responses gives us a platform as honorable members in this committee to can synthesize, you know, the presentation that has been made before us. And the best of dealing with it is to make sure that we are able to get more clarity from the side of the presenter today. And we'll take it from there. Honorable Swart, followed by Honorable Mutimele, Honorable Van Rooyen, and Dr. George.
Thank you, Chair. Just to the Governor, you know, given the fact that we have a limitation of shareholding to 10,000 and that there's a fixed dividend, you know, and everybody that became a shareholder was absolutely aware of that when they bought it. To what would you ascribe the fact that, you know, the share price is so high at the moment? I think you mentioned something like in excess of 6,000 rand at some stage. And to what would you ascribe that?
I'm going to take each question, or do you want to take them together?
I prefer that you take them together. Mutima.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me start by just getting clarity from you, Mr. Monite. Okay. Just for interest's sake, you, I heard you saying that the Reserve Bank is not governed by the Company Act, which is true. And it's also not governed by the PFMA. Now, I was just asking myself as to how do you manage the financial accountability? What legislation is there? Now, the second area is that, Chairperson, we have been listening to presentations the whole week, and in my observation, from all we had, there is nobody that denies the fact that Parliament must play a major role in the Reserve Bank, and also that the Reserve Bank is not a private company and it should not be a private company. That is what came across, and then also the role of citizens. Now, the important role the citizens should play. The governor now, the issues that were raised before that was that the corporate governance, those were issues that were raised. And then as far as I remember, I haven't gone through King 3 report, but I've gone through King 2 report. something that has elements of government, but would be service delivery principles, accountability, consultation, and then discipline, and also issues of the role of shareholders, limited role of shareholders were raised. The issue of the powers of management versus the board. But as I was listening to the governor was articulating those rules very well. Now, I was just compelled to try to look for the critical path, or what will be the critical path here. Now, I came to the conclusion that maybe I should ask the legal drafters, or is that what has been raised, is the articulation that was given by the governor and what has been raised catered for in the amendment as far as the legality is concerned? Because as government or as committee, we'll be interested in coming up with a perfect piece of legislation. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, so some of the issues that I'm going to raise, I think, will be calling for more light to be shed on the response. And some of the issues are issues that I think were not catered for in the response of the Reserve Bank and National Treasury. The first issue, Chair, when we look into the amendments that the bill tried to effect, that's according to submission that we have received, Section 22, which deal in the main about issues of shareholders. In most of the submissions that we have received, it emerged clear that then there is a conclusion that this particular amendment disregards the constitutional provision, that is Section 9, Subsection 3, which deals mainly with aspects of equity, by discriminating against shareholders and potential shareholders. When we come to aspects of defining associates or maybe those related to current existing shareholders, because in the most of the submissions, the argument is that these other people are also entitled, I mean, to these shares, and the Constitution is very clear in terms of their entitlement. I think I will appreciate if we get more information around this particular area. And then the second issue, Chair, is on the aspect of good governance, as obviously captured by Honorable Mutimela. Because the conclusion that one derives from the submission, some of the submissions, is that more powers all of a sudden are vested now with the governor's office. And when we look into the functions of the board in terms of aspects of corporate governance, I mean, it says, in a nutshell, the governor will be more of a referee and a player at the same time. And then thirdly, Chair, on the issue of the skills that are referred to, I think an example was made around this area of the sector of agriculture. When you say we want people with agricultural skills, you don't specify the level of that skill. And as a result, some of the submissions are of the impression that this might compromise the appropriateness of the skills that are required for that particular sector. So it must be emphasized what level of the skills are we looking at according to the submissions that have been received. I would like a response to that one. And lastly, Chair, there was also a submission that was focusing on the distinction that is there between the term of office of the governor as well as deputy governors linked to the directors. I think more clarity was sought around why this difference, because one of the things that we must strive for is an aspect of certainty and stability, I mean, within this important institution. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Governor and Treasury, for your inputs. Throughout the hearings, it's very clear that there is a expectation mismatch between shareholders and the bank, and that Parliament's going to have to resolve this through the legislative process. Governor, during the course of the hearings, mention was made that shareholders ask questions and don't get answers. If this is correct, how will the legislation resolve this problem going forward? And then also during the hearings, it was clear that there are shareholders who do want to exercise undue influence over the bank. Two of the submissions did actually talk about how they would want to influence monetary policy and, in fact, the operation of the entire banking system in South Africa. Are you satisfied that this legislation removes this problem, or does Parliament need to have a further look at the legislation in the future to make sure that this goes away forever? And then finally, it was raised that Parliament should have a role in the appointment of the board and in closer oversight of the bank. Do you think that this should be included in the legislation? Thank you, Chair.
I think we should allow you, Governor, to respond, and then we'll take the next round of questions.
I will try to do them in the sequence that they asked. Mr. Swart, first the question of share price, why so high? Well, let's look at the high in relation to a number of levels of share price. The share price, the shares were issued at a nominal value of 1 rand each. We used to be traded on the stock exchange, and you a few years ago was... that was delisted, and you now can do OTC. But the share price ranged in and around 1 rand, 1 rand, a little bit above, a little bit below. And that, to me, was appropriate, not because we fixed it there, but because it makes it accessible to ordinary people. If you have a high share price, part of the question here is this, the approach that I would see in relation to shareholding is it needs to be affordable. The higher the share price, the more exclusive, and the more that ordinary people are not able to participate in the bank. If you're in a situation, you want a role in the bank and the share price is at 1 rand, you have to spend 200 rand and you've got a vote, you attend the AGM, you're able to get the documentation, you become part of any roadshow, all of those things become possible. And for me, that is what the shares should be doing, so that as South Africans, as institutions, as organizations, this is the central bank of the country. And I would love to see, and I know it's not reasonable, but assume you have 10,000 shares at a maximum. At 10,000 rand, it is affordable for some, but if you want a much lesser number, simply to be able to participate, because to me the issue here is participation, not ownership, right? Because why you put a maximum is that's the number of votes at a maximum. But if you want views of ordinary people, and it relates to your question, Swanwin, about participation, what is ordinary citizens' participation? The real question would be, and I'll deal with it, one in the shareholding question and one in a non-shareholding manner. But around price, that's why price matters to us. It's because it limits to people who have wealth to a certain degree, who are, can be shareholders, and you therefore then have shareholders of a particular class able to come in and elect representatives. And our approach would be broaden that as much as possible. And therefore the price is important in that. The current share price trades at around 12 Rand 50, and partly it trades around that because of promises made, the point you're making, Mr. George, around false expectations or unrealistic expectations or different expectations. If there's a promise that the shares we're going to now be getting because you want profit, you want the distribution of the reserves, and therefore the share price is for sale, a share is for sale because you're valued in what you think a share price would be should the reserves be distributed to you, which is your objective, you value it at over 6,000 Rand a share. Now, which ordinary person in this country can buy 6,000 Rand a share? it's not there. So it's again a limiting factor, but it's also speculation. You're introducing speculation into the shares of the bank. And this is wholly improper. So the price really does matter. And for me, the approach that we would like to see in the bank is a much wider range of shareholding, shareholding that is affordable, that lots of people or organizations or federations or whatever it is, our business, small business, unions, whatever you want, individuals, say the bank matters to me. I'd like to spend 200 rand. I'd like to spend 200 rand, buy a share, have a vote, and attend and participate. So that's one level of in relation to the price. So in my view, it's there because you're speculating and you're trying to set a goal. You're making certain assumptions and you're trying to translate that into a monetary reward. In relation to, do you want to deal with the FMA? And then I'll come back in.
Okay. In terms of the constitution, the SARB is governed by the SARB Act. So that act will deal with how it's accountable. And remember that this, because they have shareholders, there's an accountability to shareholders, so they have annual general meetings, and obviously there's a public interest and they're accountable to Parliament. Now, whilst the Act doesn't have to deal with all of those issues, some of it are dealt with the practices of Parliament, where the SARB is asked to come and report on various of its policies to Parliament time to time. But in terms of their financial management and so on, it's governed by their Act. We've got lots of lawyers here. I'm not a lawyer, but I'm sure they can just confirm Rebecca or Johan. But that Act deals with all those kinds of issues.
Just in terms, sorry, I was just distracted a little bit, so I didn't hear you fully. But in terms of this, as I think you've covered, is that our accountability in terms of finance is to the shareholders, to the public, to yourself. We table an annual report to Parliament in which our financials are fully set out. And as you know, we are available to appear before the committee at any point in time and answer any questions, including about the annual report and the financials. So it is a public accountability. It's externally audited. And it's there for all to see at all times. So, you know, in that sense, there is a real public accountability about our finances in terms of our own act. And it is tabled at the AGM. And should there be any questions around the issues raised financially, the Treasury can look at that and say, we would like to have a look at this and audit that. And they have, it's in the Act, and they've done it before. When we had this whole exposure around GFECRA, it was a question that the Treasury said, look, we want to understand exactly how this got to this kind of balance. You will remember at one point we reached a negative, I think it was about $23.5 billion. And Treasury said, look, how did this happen? And we want to be sure that this is properly accountable because it's for their account. And that comes back. I mean, I'd love to have the shareholders be called upon to pay that, just as they pay profits. But it was for their account, and they said, we want to order it. And they audited it, and they're totally entitled to. So in that sense, I think that the financial accountability is very thorough. And we would be very clear to make sure that it is thorough because it is an institution that cannot afford to not have sound financials, which is hence my concern about losses, which we can deal with separately. In terms of the role of the citizen, I think I've addressed you, Honourable Matamela, a little bit in the sort of the citizen role, which is about the ability to participate as a shareholder, which would enable knowledge. But there are other ways as well that we think are extremely important for a central bank. First of all, the way that we've tried to deal with monetary policy is to ensure that we have a live broadcast of it and that we speak to it so that ordinary citizens throughout the country are able to, if they have the opportunity, to able to sit and listen to SABC or anything else and actually see what we're saying and how we're saying it. The second thing that we do, and we've looked at how we can expand this, is that we hold monetary policy forums around the country, which we invite business, academics, students, as much as possible to ensure that we, on a quarterly, it's half year, it's twice a year. We go around, members of the MPC do this. We have other people who do it as well. Those would be those who make presentations to the MPC. But all members of the Monetary Policy Committee go out and explain to the country at forums around the country, and everyone's invited. You try and make it as inclusive as possible. It varies in its success. Sometimes you have a few hundred people, sometimes not. But we're looking at expanding that role. Brian Hoge is responsible for that in our office. And to see that you actually are able to engage in an organized way with citizens. Your other question made about corporate governance. You know, there's a great deal said about corporate governance, and it's thrown out like the bank has lousy corporate governance. Tell me what. I would like to know the specifics about the corporate governance that is poor. Because let's face it, with corporate governance, there's always room for improvement. None of us in this country or around the world would be able to say our corporate governance is absolutely what we would like. But within the confines of what our responsibilities are, we try to meet the corporate governance requirements. So, for instance, if you take at the moment King III, which is the latest version of corporate governance, the approach we're taking in the bank is to, we've discussed with the Institute of Directors and our external auditors, and we look at it and say, King III has come out. We want to do a complete assessment to see what King III requires and where the gaps are and where there are gaps that we think we cannot meet because of the nature of the work that we do. We must explain that, which is what King is about, comply or explain. And where there are gaps that we think we should comply with, and that it would, what would it take to comply, we will certainly do that, and it will be something that will feature in our annual report about our compliance. I'm not sure we would be at the point where we can say that we've finished the work for this annual report, but certainly a process that we're following will be available in the annual report, and then where we comply and where we don't comply will certainly feature in the annual report, as it should, with the approach of comply or explain. So governance is extremely important to us, and that comes back to the nature of the board, which I think is a little bit of your questions, Mr. Honourable Van Nguyen, is the nature of the more powers and so on. It's not about more powers. It's about the fact that a body or an institution like a central bank, not just our central bank, the board has a governance role, not a policy role. You know, if you choose to have a policy role, which is optional, I mean, some banks do. Most have governance boards. Some banks have policy boards. So let's take the example here. Here you have a shareholder, elected representative onto the board, who sees profit motive, but you have a policy board. Okay? That policy board then, and they're busy in business. Say that they are a CEO of a big company. But they're on your board. How does that CEO of that company be engaged in setting monetary policy and have no conflict of interest? It's impossible. Even now, your non-exec directors come from, you draw them from different walks of life because you want their knowledge of those walks of life, what they're seeing and happening, right? But that very knowledge that you want should not be able to influence what your decision is around monetary policy, because there's a huge conflict. So the fact that it's a governance board is to see that we have the appropriate framework, that we have the accountability, that our audit is working, our risk is working, our HR strategies are there, we have succession, we have the skills that we need. All of these things are there, right? But how we do our job and what we do, that's an accountability to the minister. The law requires us to submit an annual report of monetary policy to the minister. That's our responsibility, not to the board. Because of the question that we have, the governors have, it's stipulated, the governors can have no other activity. That is their job, so that you avoid a conflict of interest. So that, to me, is why a governance board is so important, because it must see that the framework for governance, what is happening, what your compliance is, how do you explain some of the discrepancies is there? But it can't be about setting monetary policy. It can't be about regulation of a bank. If you have a member of the board cannot serve on a bank board, if I'm right, yeah, precisely because we regulate the banks. Okay, so when you ask what are the skills that you require, what are the limitations, there are certain limitations to who can serve on a bank board, the SARB board. And one of them is you cannot serve on a bank because we regulate you, right? You can serve on another company, but it doesn't mean that there's no conflict of interest potential. And that's why it's very important that you limit the role to the board. Second of all, the governors as the executive must be accountable. If you have a situation where the board is taking the decisions and not the executive, the executive has a wonderful situation because you can simply say, but that wasn't our view. You didn't listen to us. That was your view. It didn't work. So you can't hold me accountable at all. This way, the buck stops. There's nobody else. So if things don't go right, you have the absolute ability to hold my feet to the fire. I have no excuse to say the board said the policy should be the following. We tried to advise them that it couldn't work that way. So it is about creating the checks and balances around that. And I think those are extremely important questions. When you coming back to the powers of management versus board, and I think that answers your question, is that we have to be, and that's why this amendment is so important, because it formalizes what has been the practice in terms of ensuring that it's not a delegated function. In terms of the current act, the 1989 Act, it's a delegated function. Should you have the mischief succeed on the board, and you have a board that then says, no, no, guys, we're changing the delegation, we don't have any ability to deal with that then because the law enables that. The fact that you've had board members who were committed to the interests of the bank enabled that to be a delegated function that did not create problems. But our view, given what has been going on, we want it certain. You do not want ambiguity about it. You don't want ambiguity of accountability, and you don't want ambiguity of the certainty that you have where the responsibilities lie and whose job is what. If we looked at the question of equity, discriminating against shareholders in relation to associates, I don't think it does. And I'd ask the legal counsels to add to that. The question of associate is because you want to act in concert. If you looked at it here, the whole purpose of this act is to limit the influence so that you can have all these shares, you can own them, right? But your vote is limited because you're acting in concert with a particular purpose. And as I said earlier, historically you would have a spouse, two people who may be spouses are holding shares. They may vote the same, they may vote differently, but they didn't act in order to influence. What we're seeing here, and it's come through, I think, very clearly in your submissions, is that you act, and it's very clear as to what is said, is that, I mean, we certainly have been advised that some shareholders consider themselves the shareholder voice or active representative, and can influence up to 25% of the vote. And as we use the example of the 2003 shareholding, they actually passed a resolution to do something as shareholders, which is not in the interest of the bank. They were acting in concert. If one wanted to just look at some of the letters and communication that goes out, and I would like to read this. This says, and I won't give the name who it's written to, but it's written to a shareholder, to shareholders. But this is a specific shareholder. But it's written to all shareholders, or a number by particular people, okay? We are shareholders of the South African Reserve Bank. We would like to buy more Saab shares for our expanding family. And as the OTC trading is very thin, we would like to approach you directly for a possible sale of all or some of your 10,000 Saab shares. We would suggest a premium payment of around 25% on the current last price of 2 Rand a share. This would amount to 25,000 for all your shares. Would you consider selling during the course of the year? Attached is a tariff slipping request for a prepaid envelope. Alternatively, you can reach us. Thank you. Now, is this what you're wanting to do? That's why you need the associate question. Because when you're doing this, when you have people who are actively soliciting to buy other people's shares, to act and create a pool of influence, which is why you need. So it is not discriminating against shareholders in a sense of what you can do with a genuine shareholder, but it is limiting the question that you can act in concert with the motivation that you require. So does it limit? Yes, it does. That's its intent. But it's limiting your mischief. It's not limiting your ability to hold shares or exercise your vote. So you can hold as many shares, if you like, as in your family or as in your friends or whatever. It's when you want to act together that the limit is, your 10,000 is the limit of your vote to prevent the mischief. If we looked at more powers, I think I've addressed the question of more powers of the governor's office. It's not more powers. The governor has very, very clear responsibilities, and he's making clear that those reside with the governor and governors as distinct from the board. and it's clarifying what the board's role is in that sense. If we looked at the question of skills, the skills that are required, and that's why we come back to knowledge of, it's not a skill that gives you a test. You don't have to be a PhD in something. It's knowledge of a sector or an industry or the economy as a whole. And in very much those would be determined by what do we expect of board members. And board members, if you looked at some of the requirements, the board members need a knowledge of a whole range of things. They need a knowledge of finance. You have to have finance people to serve on an audit committee. You'd like to have some people with knowledge of risk to serve on a risk committee and finance. If you looked at HR, you'd want board members who understand HR. You'd like people to understand the economy as a whole. So that the skills are not stipulated about your sector. They're stipulated about the role you would play in the board. And it's a question then that the panel would have to determine a terms of reference and a criteria. It's the same way if you look for a governor, if you need to appoint a governor. What is the skill set you require, not just from the individual governor, but the team of governors? So when the president exercises his mind on appointing a governor, there is a set out in relation to say, these are the skills in composition of the whole. But you're unlikely to find that in one person. You should look at the whole of the four and say, in the four, do we have that appropriate skill set? And you set that out. And then you look at the tasks of the governors. And as we set some of them out there, you would say we have to deal with payment systems, currency, financials, markets, bank supervision. You know, what knowledge does a governor have to be able to execute that? You have national and international relations. You're busy on the G20 and the Bank for International Settlements. You speak for the country. What skill set do you require? And I think that's part and parcel of a panel that would develop an objective set of criteria so that when you're looking at it, you would be looking at representativity, you would be looking at gender, you would be looking at skill set, you'd be looking, and that still needs to be developed in that regard. The distinction between governance representatives and or the term of office of governors, I don't have a problem with a differentiated term that a governor has a 5-year term and a non-exec director has a 3-year term. I don't think that's necessarily a problem. Because you know, your whole process can be that your term is renewed. If you looked at King, it's a question of when you get to 9 years, have you lived outlived your shelf life? So you do have the ability for continuity. 3 years is quite useful because, you know, skill sets change and the world changes quite a bit, and I think it doesn't do any harm to have a 3-year as distinct from a 5-year term for the governors. I think the other point made in the submissions was the process of fit and proper, and that shareholder-elected representatives, shareholder-elected board members would have to go through, would be submitted to a panel through an open process, and the question that a government-appointed representative does not have to do that. Our own view is that that point is taken, and I think it's something that you know, in the ministry will look at in terms of the process around that. I don't think that that would be a difficulty to address at all in the practice around that. On the questions of mismatch of expectations, I think there's no question there's a mismatch of expectations. And I think that's unfortunate because it's not that there have not been repeated efforts and explanation about this is a different being. This is not, if you invested for that reason in 2000 and whenever, it's absolutely clear if you looked at the law what the intention was, the discussions have been around it, so that there's a persistence about an expectation because I think it's about the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow that is being chased. And the question about shareholders asking questions that don't get answered, I can't answer that for the past. I can make it very clear for the future and for the current is that I would certainly, with the amendments, I was a bit reluctant before the amendment. I hope that this does go through as it stands without amendment to the amendment, and I would certainly be happy to go on roadshows to shareholders to engage with any questions. I think that's part of the responsibility that we have. I do not see it as something out of the ordinary. I think it is perfectly entitled, shareholders are perfectly entitled to expect that, and that to answer any questions that they raise. But there's got to be a difference between answering questions around the functioning of the bank and maybe, as you pointed out, changing the entire monetary system. That's a different issue. There's also a question of it's got to be an engagement that treats both parties with respect. You know, to be quite honest, it can't be something that on a weekly basis or a daily basis I'm having to spend a number of hours dealing with shareholder queries. That is about the kind of issues we're dealing with here. I pointed out the amount of time this is taking. And, you know, I do think at some point, I know in legislation you have a concept of a vexatious litigant. And, you know, maybe at some point in time this needs to be looked at differently. You know, I do think that would this legislation remove that problem? No. I hope it removes the risk. Because for me, if you've got a shareholder who wants to ask 20 questions and wants the AGM to spend the whole day, I'm perfectly fine with that. Because it's about questions. Even if whatever I may think of the question, the shareholder has the right to ask the question. So that's different. And in between, you know, as I said, as long as it isn't a point of becoming vexatious. But it's about genuine issues and real issues, and it isn't about this question of different expectations and therefore we must meet your expectations, because that, I think, is unrealistic. But if it's about real issues of the bank, absolutely you're entitled to questions, to answers, and you're entitled to ask questions at the AGM about the entirety of what the bank does, because that's your job as a shareholder. So if you're concerned about something, certainly, and you're entitled to an answer, and that is my commitment to shareholders. In that regard. So would this legislation solve the problem of a shareholder who wants to act in that manner? In my view, no. But I don't think that this would be unusual. Many companies have shareholders who ask, and they would say they consider them as a difficult shareholder. Right? That's different. The question of this amendment is to protect the interests of the bank and do away with the risk that shareholders can act in concert and elect members to a board that can alter or stifle or inhibit or hinder the objective, purposefulness, competency, efficiency of that bank. And that's the amendment, I think, does. So I'm perfectly happy if the existing shareholders remain shareholders and ask all their questions. That's not my issue. It's the question that they should not be able to exercise acting in concert in a manner that will create a risk for this bank. And that's what the amendment for me is about. The role of in the appointment of the board and parliament, I've tried to explain why we thought in the development of this that Nedbank was appropriate, because it has a core responsibility. But I also think that the relationship with parliament is an oversight one. And I think that the oversight one is the role that should be looked at. If you wanted us down before the committee once a month, we come. If you want us to talk through the annual report, absolutely. It's an oversight role. If you looked at it and said, how has this worked? Has there been a question, what is happening at your annual general meeting? Is it working? Is it what is happening? That's your role. But the minute, my sense would be, is that if you were part and parcel of appointing the board, your oversight role is weakened. And I think we need both. I think we need to have the ability to have the board proceed in this way, and that the oversight becomes something that the committee is comfortable with, whatever that intensity is. And as I've indicated before to the committee, we're happy to come down on any basis that you feel appropriate. For instance, the Bank Supervision Department's annual report came out a couple of weeks ago. That goes to the minister, it gets tabled in Parliament. Our suggestion to the chair was that we come down and we go through that with you, because it's a hugely important question given the changing regulation. And that's the oversight role that I think that Parliament should play. The extent of the intensity of that is up to you to determine, and we will meet with whatever the intensity required. Our view, it is good, and it meets also some of the question of public participation, that people can come to the hearings, it's airing of the issue, it's questions being asked that inform the public. And the more informed the public are, I think the better, the stronger the South African Reserve Bank will be. So I would say that there's a distinction for me between the two. And the role for me is not in the appointment, it's in the oversight. I've tried to cover the questions as them. I don't know if there are any additions.
Chair,
Jay, I think, you know, just a point I wanted to make, I think just in response to the comments, I think that you will see from the response of the governor that we are quite concerned with really having the highest standards of governance, that nobody's saying we're perfect, and to the extent that there's scope to improve, we're very open to improving. But, I mean, to make the point that I think the reputation and integrity of the central of the Reserve Bank is critical. And I think it's quite important that we guard that almost with our lives, because I think their functioning would be impossible if there was any doubt on this front. And I think that spreading all kinds of unsubstantiated allegations, I think it's a dangerous game which some shareholders are playing with fire here. Thanks.
Okay, I suggest that I know we still have got a tetrasent and probably some follow-up questions from your side, honorable members, but I suggest we take 10 minutes comfort break and come back. I think we should proceed. I have noted honorable Tetra, Goran Wolf. Any other follow-up question or any new question? Okay. To the appears, this is going to be the shortest interaction since we started this process. It means the responses are straightforward. Okay. Honorable Mteto?
Thanks, Chair. Thanks for some clarification on most of my question by the government. But there's only one that is remaining. That should we, do you think, Governor, if we can extend the this presentation, what do you think new might come out except what we have received by now? Because there was a lot of issues of time. Do you think anything new may still come up, or will be still on the same issues that we are discussing as currently? That the second question is about, I know you have touched it, the issue that some shareholders or board members want to influence the monetary policy. How is this thing going to happen? The last one, are there in the current one, are there any other people that are holding more than this 10,000 shares? Also, yeah, holding more than the 10,000, and they are, how many do you think they are? There about 50%, 50% or less? Those are my questions that I wanted to be clarified on it.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you for the submissions this morning. IDASA submission was, according to my judgment, a very good submission. And they were very much concerned about, you know, the not enough a role for Parliament, especially with regard to the board, the appointment of the board. And I think you've spelled that out. It's over to us, you know, to play our own oversight role, and the governor is willing, you know, to participate, or the Reserve Bank. But they've made a point here to say that having eight directors appointed, you know, by presidential appointees, they call it, that undermines the independence of the Reserve Bank. And I just would like your comments on that.
Thanks very much. Maybe to start with the last one. On the eight appointments, I tried to explain to me, first of all, I think there are a number of things here. The emphasis that there has been in the past about who appointed you as to what your duties and responsibilities are has created a false role or an improper role for the board. The board is a unitary board, and it has a duty of scare and kill, and a duty of care and skill, not scare and kill. I like it. Mr. Durr, you didn't know how much you've influenced me subconsciously, eh? duty of care and skill. The board, that is the board's role, irrespective of the vehicle through which it has been appointed. So for me, if there's a different expectation of a non-executive member appointed by the government as distinct from those appointed by shareholders, then I think we've got a problem on the board. Because all of the responsibilities of the board is to see that the organization functions appropriately. And the actual number, as I said, I think it's a reasonably small board. The number for me would be the additional person is one. You know, and it's again an evaluation that needs to be made quite carefully. Is the role of the governor as chair appropriate or inappropriate in a central bank? Because I think all governance points to the fact that there should be a separation of roles. But given that this is a governance board and the operational side and the cohesion between the two, at this point in time, you do have the governor as chair and governor with a casting vote. It puts the position that the governor's casting vote becomes the deciding factor all the time, should there be voting. As I said, I have no experience of it so far. But should things not go well, and you do have that, then you're putting the situation of the governor in terms of that as the arbiter. And I think that this creates the opportunity, should that be the route that is chosen, to appoint a chair, that it's quite easy to do, and you don't have even numbers, which is important. So I think there's no problem for me around the extra person and that it is from government, because the responsibility should be irrespective. So I don't think it's about undermining your independence. And again, I think it's I want to just dwell on this question of independence for a minute, because, and I think it's come up in one of our committees before, when I've appeared before you, I think maybe in November, there has been a sense that independence implies opposition to government. And that's not the case. Independence is about how you exercise your mind over specific duties and responsibilities. And in that regard, the independence of mind is about how you exercise monetary policy. So that's the question. Are you part and parcel as a national asset that needs to be dealt with in relation to the needs of the country? I think that the way we've dealt with independence has, in fact, probably narrowed the kind of role that a reserve bank can play in an economy and in a society, unfortunately, because it's been interpreted that as independent you become the very black box that sits there and nobody knows what's going on because you're independent. Whereas to me, the independence is how you exercise your mind over specific responsibilities. It's a very big, different question. So for me, on the 8, I'm not uncomfortable with that. I think it creates the appropriate... You know, if you had 7-7 and the governor's got a casting vote, you still have. If your interpretation is that gives you a weight against independence, you've already got it because the governor has a casting vote. So it is, in essence, if you had a conflict 8-7 anyway. So I don't think it does that. I think it just gives you a little bit more room. If you want to go the route of a chairperson, that you have an odd number rather than an even number, and so on. So I don't think it does any harm. Perhaps just creates a little bit more space. In relation to the not enough role of Parliament, again, it depends on what you see as your role, you see. And I, as I said, I would very much welcome an oversight role in whichever way you've determined it, because I think the more oversight, the more engagement, the more ability to talk about the work of the bank and explain it and be part and parcel, because it's not just for explaining here. It's a question that when you have that kind of engagement, you all have responsibilities in relation to the other work you do. You have constituency work, you have committees, you have all kinds of things. The more knowledgeable you are about the work of the bank, the better. You know, for us, the greater the public has an understanding of the role of the bank and the complexities that you're dealing with and the economic environments that we work in, the better. As I said, I would think that obviously it's my subjective view, but I would think that a different role of appointing through a body that is, again, properly constituted, which is NEDLAC, it is not the governor picking people. It is a body that represents a whole body of society in law, and is established in law, but it represents that, is again an appropriate body, and it creates the check and balance that I think you need. So for me, I think Idaho's submission around that can be interpreted in a number of ways. I would not see it narrowly as about a role in appointing the board, but I would see it as oversight and enhanced oversight in whatever way that is. And in many ways, I mean, one of the complexities around this, of course, is because being the very nature it is, if there are questions around it in the House, it goes through Parliament and through the Ministry of Finance. And that in itself is rather complicated because we're not a reporting entity. We have a responsibility to be independent, including from the ministry, although you have an interaction, a formal interaction with the minister, but you're not a reporting entity. And therefore, the oversight role becomes something that the committee, I think, needs to think about slightly differently in relation to how we do that. Because simply asking questions and having answers, they can't speak for us. And if they were to speak for us, they would find that there'd be a lot of pushback. So, you know, I just think it's more complex in the role of oversight that I would welcome the committee looking at in a way. If we came to the question of what more would you hear if there was more time for hearings, I'm not sure you'd hear anything else. Bear in mind that this is a group or a relatively small number of people within the number of shareholders. I mean, we also get lots of letters from shareholders to say we like what you're doing. Thank God, thank goodness somebody is now dealing with this because this has just become totally unpleasant. And so on. So I don't think you'd hear more or differently from what you have already heard if you had more time to have hearings. You might get more of the same. And then we would talk some more. The influence on monetary policy, we're saying precisely that we think that you need to develop the board in a manner that it does not influence monetary policy because it'd be totally inappropriate to do that. Does that mean that we are accountable? Yes, not just to the board. In terms of monetary policy, we're accountable to the whole country. And we do that every 2 months when we stand up in front of the public and say what we're doing. And everybody comments on us. You know, the question about it is you really are scrutinized from top to bottom on every word that you said. So there's a huge accountability in relation to monetary policy from the public as well. In terms of people holding more than 10,000 shares, there are actually 8 families. Well, 8, why don't you say, rather than sort of be ventriloquist here, just give the report.
Yes, thank you. From the records that we have, we obviously don't know who are all associates and so forth. That we'll have to determine later on. But if we talk about close family members, from the records that we have, we have 8 families, close family members. And if I can start off, first family member, 100,000. Second family member, 80,000. Third family member, a group of families or members, just close family members, 40,000. Fourth one is 25,000. Fifth one is 30,000. Sixth one is 16,000. Seventh group of close relatives, 30,000, and then the eighth family is 40,000. And then we have, as Mr. Durr claims, and I'm quoting here from what he said in the Durr, is it Ball's online article. Mr. Durr claims that he and his family, together with other associates, own 15% to 20% of the share in the bank. According to the bank's estimation, this figure stands at some 9.4%, which means that Mr. Durr and his family and associates hold at least 57.5% of the total number of shares of the bank, held by persons that are not resident in the Republic. However, if Mr. Durr's claim is correct, then he could have acquired more shares from other shareholders outside the official OTC-SDF system. In this regard, Mr. Durr's wife did in 2007 want to obtain more shares at an offer to purchase shares at a premium of 25%. So this is what we have that has been disclosed by himself.
Perhaps just a point on the share register. As things stand in keeping with the regulations, The share register is not a public document. We table a copy of the share register on an annual basis to the minister. Our own view would be there's absolutely no reason why it should not be a public document, and we are in discussion with the minister in terms of saying that if, as we feel we need to work through the regulations, and this would be one that we would like to amend and to make it a public document. I don't know if we've covered all the questions, Chair.
I would want to assume so in the absence of any... Oh, Honourable Van Rooyen.
Chair, my question is that by the latest statement, it has nothing to do with the amendments, but it's triggered by the latest statement by the Governor that the shareholder document is not a public document. I'm not sure if what was done in our last meeting. I'm not sure if what was done was adhering to that particular provision, or maybe this platform is not regarded as a public platform, because my understanding is that this platform is open to the public.
It is open to the public, but the question there is different in terms of the shareholder register is not secret. In that sense, it's not public. Certainly, if you went to a website that Mr. Durr runs, he does have a whole list of shares that he has put on there as shareholder register. But the execution of the legal counsel in explaining this to the committee is not a leak of information about shareholders. This is about it's totally in compliance with the legal framework. The legal counsel was doing his job. He is explaining what is happening to the bank. He's explaining what was occurring. He hasn't leaked for personal benefit in any form or for manipulation. He's advised the bank, the committee at a public hearing, what is happening. So that in terms of the allegations that he was in violation of the bank's Secrets Act is not accurate at all. He revealed that in the course of doing his duty, which is totally legal and what his responsibility is. It's not something that, is a violation of the legislation.
Becca just informed me to update you what the Treasury has done. Maybe you should just say, rather than get it secondhand from me.
Thank you. Just to clarify, the register has been tabled in Parliament in terms of provisions of the African Reserve Bank Act by the Minister of Finance.
It's now a public document.
Honourable Judge, maybe before you raise your question, I just wanted to bring it to the attention of National Treasurer and the Reserve Bank Governor that the reasons why honourable members are asking these questions with regard to the disclosure of shareholders and so on and so forth is out of concern, because in our presentation, one of the shareholders said, in actual fact, after you disclose information to this committee, you should have surrendered yourself to the police station. Now I'm sure they are worried, these honourable members, that what's going to happen to you from here. But as far as I'm concerned, Parliament can summon anybody and ask any information. So if we are expected to deal with this matter diligently, so we should be informed about the challenges. And this brings me to the other issue that you raised earlier on Honourable Governor, Governor of the Reserve Bank. Oh, thank you very much. Thank you. You used to sit on this chair. Now,
but I'm honourable in the sense of I'm not dishonourable. You're honourable by virtue of your position.
Now, you see, there's information that has come before this committee today about exchanges of information and letters written to shareholders and so on and so forth by other shareholders or board members, I'm not sure. I think it would be important for us as the committee to know who these people are, if they are shareholders, if they are board members, as part of full disclosure for us to be able to deal with this issue. Because one of the things that I would personally not like and probably hate, I don't want to bring my personal feelings into this matter, is for citizens of this country to be hoodwinked. If people appear before this committee, they must be do so because they really believe, and genuinely so, that their case is honest and they are not doing any other thing that they are not disclosing to this committee. So I would prefer that we need that information before the end of this meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me address the question of secrecy and confidentiality, because various allegations have been made. In the first instance, I think it's necessary to point out that Section 33 of the Reserve Bank Act, which is the relevant section which is being referred to with regard to so-called breaches of secrecy, applies to the bank, its employees, and its directors, and not to other persons, by the very nature of the fact that that's who Section 33 applies to. So a director or employee of the bank must not breach the secrecy provisions where it has an obligation to maintain secrecy. Secondly, so I don't believe there's any concern that if information is disclosed to this committee in a bona fide manner, that it can ever be a breach of such secrecy by the committee members. But let's talk about the secrecy vis-a-vis the bank, its directors, and its employees. Section 33 of the Reserve Bank Act says something very important. It says that where an employee, in the exercise of his duty and his function, and in the case of the General Counsel, when the General Counsel appears before a Parliament committee, he's exercising his duty as General Counsel to disclose the difficulties that the bank is experiencing, there's a carve-out in the Act, and it says he cannot be breaching the provisions of Section 33 where he is acting in accordance with his duty in respect of the Banks Act. I think there's a whole misconception with regard to breach of secrecy in Section 33 of the Reserve Bank Act, and there's no breach of secrecy in that regard. So I would not think any of the members of this committee should be concerned in that regard. It's been disclosed to them in good faith, and nobody has to present themselves to the police station. To take the matter further with regard to certain letters which have been read out, the moment a person decides to publish a document, by its very nature it is no more secret. It's not secret any longer. They have put it in the public domain, and there's a carve-out. When you put something in the public domain, secrecy no longer applies to that document. With regard to the letters which were written out, they were written in open letters to shareholders by, in the one case, Mr. Lang, and in the other case, Mr. Durr, Mr. Durr's wife, being the two letters which were written out regarding asking to be appointed as a director and offering to make payment in that regard, and secondly, offering a premium for the ability to purchase shares. So those were letters not written to the bank. They were written to shareholders in the public, and those shareholders forwarded these letters to the bank. So I don't believe there's any question regarding secrecy. If they chose to put it in the public domain in that fashion, there's no contravention of the secrecy provisions in that regard, in my view.
Thank you, Chair. The issue has largely been covered, but I just wanted to say that yes, this issue was raised regarding secrecy, and I remember very clearly that it was in fact in response to a question that I asked about what was the activity. Now, how on earth can our committee wrap its mind around anything if we don't get information? So that's just a no-brainer. But the fact that the matter was raised certainly, to my mind, demonstrates the small-mindedness and the pettiness with which we have to deal in some instances, and it really shouldn't be necessary. So I do think it does demonstrate certain attributes of individuals. And also I do think that in terms of the behavior, if there has been any behavior that's been illegal, for example, by anybody, it does need to be explored by this committee. And I do think we do need to look at letters, etc., that have been circulated, and if there has been any circumventions of anything, we do need to take the appropriate action, Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm sure we can make those letters available to you, and I'd ask legal counsel to follow up with you in that regard. But perhaps just maybe on a lighter note, you've only had a week of it. The very things that you've had about court actions and to open up charge docket and everything is what I'm dealing with on a virtually daily basis. And that's why I've made the point that the amount of time this takes and the demanding nature of it, when I'm saying demanding, not because of difficulties, the actual demands made on when you want replies and so on, makes it extremely difficult to have the kind of constructive relationship you'd want with shareholders. And I want to emphasize, I think this is a very small group of shareholders. I don't, with exercising influence, but I don't think it's the majority of the shareholders.
Any other input? Okay. I think, honorable members, Governor and your team, National Treasury, Acting DG and your team. Clearly, I think one of the things that I need to mention, which you have responded to, the issue of timelines and time frames. I fully concur with you that we have acted as a committee within the normal limitations that the committee could do its work. And within this particular framework, I think we've exhausted the possibilities of getting any other information outside what we have. We have addressed this matter already with the presenters to say once the matter has been referred to a committee cannot dismiss the matter up to infinity. We have to be simply businesslike also as Parliament. But the key issues that are contained in the proposed amendment, you have managed to clarify the issues of ownership versus participation, governance versus policy, which is very, very critical for this institution. But also to indicate to the rest of us about the possibilities that profit-making motives can undermine the overall objective of the bank itself. What I would want to check with you, I know you've already responded to this question, Governor, as to whether there are any other inputs that you think still need to go into this amendment. Throughout your presentation, you've been saying you think it will be proper that the amendments go through as they are. But I thought just for record purposes, we should know from your side as to whether there's any other input that you think would make or enrich the current proposed amendments that's contained in the bill.
Chair, just certainly as far as Treasury is concerned, we don't believe there needs to be any amendments, and the bill's fine as is. And I think that's the view. The Governor can confirm it herself.
No, we would agree with the National Treasury.
I wouldn't ask the same to committee members because I think the committee members would want to reflect after this presentation. But safe to say that we have, through the chair, been interacting with the Speaker of the National Assembly on how best can we manage this process moving forward without putting the Reserve Bank at a disadvantaged position given the time pressures that we have in dealing with this particular matter. I also have a sense that the Reserve Bank and National Treasury took a very long time to deal with these issues. Honorable Dion George says we might be dealing with very, very petty issues, which indicates that the intentions of some of your shareholders are not as good as the Act requires them to be. Now, in your presentation, you said these are things that you've been dealing with on a daily basis over a longer period of time, and my sense is that we should have attended to these issues much, much earlier. And therefore, I would leave the rest in the hands of the committee to deliberate, and we'll then make our report to Parliament in the third quarter of Parliament. I must say also, it is on record that this is one of the priority items of Parliament when we resume after this long recess. With those words, I want to wish you well and wish Bafana Bafana victory in the finals. Thank you very much. Mr. Des in Bafana Bafana T-shirt also today. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks to the committee for enabling us to participate today. And we remain available to you as you deem appropriate. Thank you very much indeed.
Honourable members, there is documentation from National Treasury and staff.